We're very thankful for the opportunity to be with you this morning. We do bring greetings from southwest Mississippi. We did not know exactly where we would go to church this morning for sure, but we did tell some of the congregation that we may be here, and they send their love. The descendants of some of the people that you're familiar with have continued steadfastly in the faith, and we're very thankful to be a part of their experience and to hear the stories of the time when there was a lot of travel between our two churches. So we're very thankful to be here this morning. Thankful for Brother Chris, and had hoped that we might be able to hear him preach this morning, but always knowing that there's a possibility, we did bring our Bible with us, Sister Tammy did drive, so we could read a little bit and consider some things. Floor being the matter this morning, we'd like to consider some text found in 1 Peter chapter 3. And it's going to be interesting to me to see how this comes around to what's on my mind and what I've been thinking on. But we'll see how this goes. You continue to pray that the Lord will be in the matter, and above all else, that he'll be glorified in whatever occurs. So let's just read a few verses here, and then we'll consider them. Begin in verse 17, and we'll read through verse 22. For it is better, if the will of God be so, that ye suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison, which sometime were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls were saved by water. The like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us, not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God, by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject unto him. Now, whether I can preach anything out of that or not, that's a glorious text. It's a glorious instruction. I find the letters that Peter wrote, while they are rooted in doctrine, and they teach sound doctrine, that they are very practical use to the Lord's church today. He is writing these things. These letters, nor are any of Paul's or James's or anybody else that's in the canon of Scripture, these letters are not written to dead alien sinners. They are written to the Lord's people. They're written to us who continue steadfastly, rooted and grounded in the doctrines of grace. They're written to us that they might shore us up, that they might encourage us, that they might instruct us in the ways that God's will provides for us to go. I like the way that he writes this. He says, for it is better if the will of God be so. If the will of God be so, I'll tell you my understanding of that is what he is saying. And if of course you go back and get chapters 3, and while you're doing that, you might as well get 1 and 2. But he's kind of culminating that here. He has instructed them that though they may endure persecution and would certainly endure persecution, he says to think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you. He knows that these people are, as the brother has prayed, as pilgrims and strangers in a land that is not their home, that they would face difficulties, they would face persecutions, they would face the various difficulties of life that a people who endeavor to serve the Lord will face. And that if God is willing to suffer them, to suffer, I guess that's the way I could say that, if God is willing to suffer them, to suffer. God's will, I get the feeling, especially in sometimes talking with young people, particularly that are not Primitive Baptists, but are sincere, God-fearing people, that they think that God has this master plan for their life. And you'll often hear them say, I'm just trying to find out what God's will for my life is. And, you know, I guess I kind of understand the desire for that. We do want to do what God would have us to do. But, brethren, this is God's will for your life. When you say you're searching for God's will for your life, you're just admitting you haven't read the will. The will's here, see. God's will for our lives is here. I do not understand God to have a particular job for you out there to do. I do not believe, I was raised to believe this, but I do not believe that God has a particular spouse out there. You just got to find them. I think God teaches us how to go about finding a vocation in a godly way. I believe God teaches us how to go about finding a spouse in a godly way. And that's the will of God for our lives. But if His will is that you suffer, and this is just common sense, but as a professor in college of mine used to say over and over again, common sense is not that common. But this is just common sense. It's better to suffer for doing good than it is for doing bad. I mean, I hope everyone in here would amen that. It's better to suffer for doing good than it is to suffer for doing bad, because if you suffer for doing bad, you compound that with your conscience. Your conscience, a child of God at least, his conscience will bother him. So whatever the consequence may be of the bad thing that you've done, you add to that the knowledge that you have broken God's law. That just compounds things. So it's better to suffer for well-doing. Now, if you go out there and you do something good and you get and you end up getting persecuted for it, now you've got the opposite thing going on. You see, because now you've got in your mind your knowledge that, and it's not important that the newspapers get this or the television news gets this or even your peer or your spouse or your children get this. What's important is that you know, and you can recognize that God knows that what you've done is great. I know at times I have preached depravity to the point that I fear that I have left some in it. And, you know, children of God who are born again, you are not only depraved. You still have a depraved nature, yes. And you still will succumb to it from time to time. If the Lord doesn't come back or you don't die first, you're going to succumb to it. But you have within you an incorruptible seed, one that cannot sin and delights when the rest of you follows its lead. In fact, over in Hebrews chapter 6, I don't have time to really get into that this morning, but Hebrews chapter 6 is an interesting chapter. It was one that as the Lord began to reveal the doctrines of grace to me, I felt like I had to understand because it seemed to contradict. It seemed to contradict some things that I was being taught. It didn't, but it did seem to in my mind. But over there, the Apostle Paul, I believe, wrote it. Whoever wrote it writes, "For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, in that ye have ministered unto the saints and do minister." Now, I used to read that to say, God, in my mind, what I would read is, God would not be unrighteous if he did forget. That's not what the text says. It says God is not unrighteous to forget. In other words, he's not going to forget. I've loved it. As a father, I've pointed out to my children on many occasions, I've had it pointed out to me that, you know, you may think you get away with something, Dad's not looking, but the Lord's always watching. So I'm quick to point out that God's watching when we do things against his will, but you know, God's also watching when we do things that are in harmony with his will. And that is a relief to the child of God. It is to me. I mean, whenever the Lord will bless, and I know where it comes from. I know that if I've done some good work, it's not because I'm such a great and good person. It's because of the grace of God. It is indeed, as Paul said, it is by the grace of God, I am what I am. And so when I've done something perhaps that I find to be in God's will, it's a comfort to me. It is a reminder to me that I am one of his and that I could not do that except God were with me, you see. So it's better if the will of God be so that you suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. And then we've got an example. Here's the example. You know, it's always often occurred to me that the Bible does not give us examples to follow that are mortal men. Now, you might say, well, Paul said, follow me. But he would caveat that. He would say, follow me in as much as I'm following Christ. See, Christ is our benchmark. Christ is our benchmark. And why is that? Why did God not say, well, Peter could be the benchmark, or maybe James or some of the others? Why is that? Because as sinful creatures, here's the way that would go. You know, maybe if I could just live up to the Apostle Paul. You know, he did a lot of bad things early on, but then he straightened his act up by God's grace and did good. So maybe if I could just attain to him, maybe that would be good enough. But then when I saw that I didn't attain to that, maybe I'd say, you know what, I can get old Peter. I identify with Peter a lot. I can get to Peter's level. And then when I fail to do that, I'd say, well, maybe that's not good enough. Maybe I'll get to Thomas. That's my namesake. So maybe I'll get to him. He doubted. And you know, if I keep that going, next thing I know I'm at Ahab or Jezebel, and maybe I can just reach to that level. See, God doesn't set though levels like that we need to reach to. He puts Christ out there. Now you may say, and you'd be right to do so, we'll never attain to that. You know, I hear people say that sometimes, but you know, I can't do that. I can't do as good as Christ did. I can't be truly Christ-like. Well, should that stop you from trying? I tell you, my son is in an archery program. He was in it in high school. He's in it in college. And he said to me one day, he said, Dad, I've never shot a perfect 50. You know, they do six rounds, and then you can score up to 300 points. And he's gotten 280s. I think maybe shot a 290, at least 280s. He said, but he really wants that perfect round. He wants that perfect round. But he's never got it. But the fact that he's never gotten that perfect round, it doesn't make him want to shoot less. It makes him want to shoot more. It makes him want to practice more. If you're a marksman of any kind, if you're even basketball, shooting free throws. I know Elder Luke Addison's daughter had a contest where she was raising money and shot free throws. And I'm just going to tell you, I got suckered into that. I gave her, said, so many for so many free throws you make. And that child made 92 out of 100 free throws. And anyway, I paid up, but I wasn't happy about it. But you know, the fact that she couldn't make 100% of them didn't stop her from practicing and trying her best to make all of them. The fact that we will never attain to the righteousness of Jesus Christ this side of glory should not hinder us from trying to do so. Because he hath once suffered the just for the unjust. There's a lot of conversation this weekend, not as much as there should be. I'll just leave it at that. There's a lot of conversation about liberty and the country that we enjoy, and we should be thankful for that. And we should be thankful for the men and women who have given their lives for that. But I've heard this said, and it's, I guess, a true statement, but I cringe when I hear it. Because they'll say, well, there are only two men have ever died for you. And that's Jesus Christ, who died for your eternal salvation, and the American soldier that died for your freedom. And, you know, that's probably true, but I just don't like putting, I mean, don't get me wrong. Now, I have great respect for the men that I was telling Sister Chambers, a movie I watched years ago, and there was an admiral that made this comment. He said, where do we get such men? You know, where do we get such men that are willing to lay down their lives for you and I? But they're not laying their lives down as the just for the unjust. Now, we respect them and we love them and we are so thankful that God has given us men that do believe that the cause of the right to do what we're doing today is worth the blood that was shed for it. But we can't elevate them to the level of Jesus Christ. Because he died the just for the unjust. He was wholly harmless, wholly harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens. He is the Lamb of God, John said, that taketh away the sin of the world. And he died, the just, for the he suffered as the just one for those of us who in and of ourselves were not worthy and did not deserve for his sacrifice to apply to us. So that should motivate us. That should motivate us while we live here to spend our time in service to one another, which is to be in service to the Lord. Now, he says, for Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit. He brought us to God. Last Sunday at Middleton Creek, we took the subject of reconciliation. That was Sunday before that. The subject of reconciliation. In Job's day, Job felt a need to be reconciled to God. You find in the ninth chapter of the book of Job, he begins it this way in verse 2. He says, for I know it is so of a truth, but how shall man be just with God? See, Job had this innate desire that we know where it came from. Job didn't know where it came from. We know that it came from the fact that he was born again of the Spirit. Same Spirit that born you again, born Job again many centuries ago. And Job had what my philosophy professor in college would have called a priori knowledge. That means he just knew some things he didn't know how he knew them. He knew them before he knew them, in other words. And Job's an interesting character. He expounds. Job's a deep thinker. But he didn't have the knowledge that you and I have. Because a little bit later in that ninth chapter, he would say that if he washed his hands with snow water and made them never so clean, you know, he got the cleanest water that he could think of in his day, and he washed his hands with that water and made them never so clean. He got his hands as clean as he can make them. Yet shalt thou plunge me in the ditch, he said. He said, it's just like I was just muddy all over again. I never got clean one whit. He said, even my clothes would abhor me. He said, then neither is there any daysman betwixt us that he should lay his hand upon us both. Neither is there any daysman. Isn't that a sad statement? Because Job couldn't see. You know that there is a daysman. We've had 2,000 years to sing praises unto that daysman. That word daysman, if you look it up in your Strong's and you get home, you're going to find that it's akin to being an umpire. It's a little different than an umpire. You might think, and sometimes it's true, I've seen very unfortunate circumstances where an umpire would try to mediate between two teams. That's not an umpire's job. An umpire is not there to put his hand on this coach and his hand on this coach and bring them together. What an umpire is there to do is he's to put his hand on the situation and his hand on the rules and reconcile that. We don't like that sometimes. Sometimes we don't like that. We think, yeah, he made it to the bag first, and we get replay and all that, and then they takes, you know, the game's added 4 hours to it because of that and all that. But we don't want that. But really we do, don't we? We want balls and strikes to really be balls and strikes. You know, I'm kind of a baseball purist. It's my favorite game, and I like to hear, you know, balls and strikes. I like to think that they're called accurately. But we all know they're not. We see it on television. I'm just waiting for the day when the umpire's not of use anymore. Anyway, I went too far into that. But that's what the word means. And when you consider the true role of the umpire, which is not to reconcile the two teams to each other, it's to reconcile the situation to the rule of law or the rules, that's what our daysman does. He reconciles us to God's rule. Now, Bible teaches that if thou markest iniquities, who shall stand? And I'll amen that. There was a time in my life, and Brother Chris, you'll be surprised to hear this. There was a time in my life when I was foolish enough to make statements like this. If you'll just leave it up to me and get out of my way, I will accomplish this salvation thing. That's pretty foolish. But that's the system that I was familiar with. That's what I wanted. That's what I thought I wanted. But in reality, when I compare from that perspective myself and I measure up against the rule, I'm found wanting, and very much so. But when I consider the daysman and what the daysman does and what the daysman knows, see, the daysman has to know the rules. We were at a mediation one time. The job I had before the one I've got now, I got because I had the credentials to testify. And in this mediation, one of the things that helped was that the mediator, is an arbitration, I guess I should say, the arbitrator, had knowledge of the industry. He had worked in the industry we were in, just so happened. And that was very helpful because I didn't have to explain a lot of the terms that I used. He was very familiar with them and knew them. And that was very helpful. See, our mediator, there's one mediator between God and man, and that's the man Christ Jesus, who not only knows the rules, but he also knows that we're dust. And so he is able to take and put his hand upon us and put his hand upon his Father. There's a picture of this in the third chapter of John when Jesus says, I think perhaps to Nicodemus, I'm not certain this was Nicodemus he's talking to, but could have been. And he says, there is no man that hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man which is in heaven. Now, if you can explain that to me, I will take your explanation because I don't understand it. I believe it with all my being, but I do not understand how Jesus could have come from heaven, be going back to heaven, and even while he was talking to them right then, he was in heaven, except he fits the description of the daysman. That he had his hand on man because he was 100% man. He had the same body you have. He had heart and lungs and kidneys, all those things, albeit without sin. And he could put his hand upon the Father. Now, Job says, I can't answer him one in a thousand. He is not a man, as I am, that we should come together in judgment, you see. See, Brother Chris and I, we get out here, get to talking, we get crossways about some text. Most of the time, there's going to be room, as long as it's not a fundamental, I understand. But there's going to be some room that we can kind of come together. He might give a little, I might give a little, so on and so forth. That's not the way reconciliation with God works, see. God is here. He is holy and just and right and good. And however many other adjectives you can describe him with. And we are sinners. But there is a daysman betwixt us that takes us and brings us not back to where Adam was in the garden, but we go all the way to where God is. He brings us. You know, there's a scene, as a marriage supper of the Lamb scene in I think it's the 19th chapter of Revelation, where the bride, I love this picture, the bride is granted that she should wear the fine linen. And you don't have to wonder what that fine linen is, because he goes on to tell us, he says, which is the righteousness of the saints. We're granted to wear the fine linen, that is the righteousness of the saints. Our righteousness comes from a husband that we've not yet seen. Beautiful picture of this in the 24th chapter of Genesis, when the bride of Isaac is being brought back to where he is. They've never seen each other. They've never met. But you know, I got to believe, Brother Chris, and this is speculation on my part, so forgive me. Brother Philip gets here, tell him I'm sorry. But I am of the opinion that she had to have heard all about Isaac along that trip. That servant, he knew him. He knew what kind of man he was, knew how rich he was. And all along that trip, don't you know she's bound to have had questions? Now, again, this is extra biblical, so you can toss it aside when we leave if you want to. But in my mind, he had built Isaac up. You know, like the best man at a wedding should do. Build him up. Make him sound great. Make her just desire grow that much more as they travel. But I can build you a really good case. I'm not going to take the time, but I can build you a good case that when she lighted off that camel to see a husband for the first time, that everything she was wearing came from him. Like it'll be the first time we see our husband. We'll be wearing everything we'll have when I've come from him. So we have a daysman. He's reconciled us. He's brought us to God. And it says, being put to death in the flesh, and we know that was the case, he was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, but quickened by the Spirit. And we know that. That's kind of our receipt. I heard Elder David Burris one time put it this way, that's our receipt. So that when the devil begins to attack us now and try to lay something to our charge, all we have to do is pull out the receipt. No. See, Christ was raised from the dead. And so that means that our debt's paid in full. And it was paid in full. When he cried out, "It is finished," it was finished. But we got everlasting proof of that when Jesus came forth out of the grave. He was quickened by the Spirit. He came forth out of the grave. And now the old devil, he can try if he wants to. But if I can just remember to do it, and I don't always, but if I can just remember to pull out my receipt. Nope, sorry, buddy. It's already paid. Actually, I'm not sorry. Thankful. It's already paid. Then he says, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison. Now, I'm going to tell you. As a child, I was beat over the head with this text. And I mean in the worst kind of way. I don't normally do this, but I'm going to tell you how I was taught this. This is wrong, okay? I'm going to tell you what I was taught regarding that text when I was growing up. I'm only going to do that so you can know how good you got it, okay? I was taught that this text was teaching that in the 3 days between the crucifixion and the resurrection, that my Lord went into the depths of hell and tried his best, and that's the way they put it, and tried his best to convince the people in hell and give them a second chance to come to believe in him and come and be with heaven, with him in heaven. If that you find that appalling, that good. I wished I'd have found it as appalling as I do now back then. Well-meaning folks, I'm sure, but that's not what this text is teaching. Okay. First off, God doesn't work on a chance system, period. God's children being in heaven with him has always been his purpose and own purpose. Okay? God does not give anybody a chance. He saved his people, period. But I am stuck with the text. Actually, I'm happy to be stuck with it. It's a wonderful text. If you begin to understand what it is teaching. And I'm going to tell you what I believe it's teaching. Now, Brother Chris may have a different take on this. I know he doesn't believe what I just told you. He may have a different explanation than what I've got here. But I'm going to give you my understanding of what this text is teaching. And it's a whole lot, in my opinion, it's a whole lot better than that. He says, by which also he went and preached to the spirits in prison. We don't have to wonder who he's talking about here. Because he says, which sometime were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah. Whoever he's talking about is alive in the days of Noah. Now, there are two views of this that I could get my arms wrapped around if I had to. Maybe another, I don't know. But I'll tell you, there's two that I could see here that I've heard and I can agree with. I can suffer one and I agree with the other. Some have taught that this is saying that Jesus Christ himself, by the Spirit, preached to Noah and his family. That in some way, Jesus appeared to them And I can't deny that, but I can't find it in the Bible. The other, and this is the view that I have of it, requires that we consider what's going on in this day. You got a man named Noah, we're all familiar with. We know that Noah lived in a time when God's long suffering with the wickedness of this planet had come to an end. And he's ready to destroy all that are on the face. And if you think about that for a minute, if you ever wonder, I wonder how really bad it was. Think about how bad things are right now. And God's letting it go for now. Not letting it go. That's not the right way to say that, but I hope you understand what I'm saying. He's not destroyed the earth now. Think about how bad things must have been in that day for God to decide, I'm wiping them out. But he goes to Noah, and I trust we all know why. And we do find in chapter 7 that God says that Noah was found in a way of righteousness. It's true, but that is not why God called upon Noah to build the ark. The reason that God called upon Noah to build the ark is one of the first verses I ever taught my children. I highly recommend it as one to teach them. Is chapter 6 in Genesis and verse 8. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. That's the reason that God called upon Noah to build the ark. And then he gave him all this instruction. And I'll tell you, I've been to Kentucky and I've seen the thing that they built up there and I liked it. Just as an aside here, the thing I liked about that place up there more than anything else was that there were multiple plaques that I saw around that said, we are not saying this is how it was done. We're saying this is how it could have been done. And I appreciate it. They made that allowance. One of the things I just disagree with is they built a thing to look like a boat, and I don't think it looked like a boat. It was an ark. It was a box. Be that as it may, it's kind of a neat trip. If you ever get to make it, I would encourage you to do so. Just eat the chicken, spit out the bones. But when you get there, one thing that you are bound to come away with is the size. This thing was huge. And they didn't have cranes. Now you can go to any modern city. We've been in several this week. And you can go to any modern city and see cranes all over the place building. And it still takes lots of years. Noah doesn't have any of that. He's got three boys, and I expect they knew how to build a ship when it was all done. But they took 100 years. Is at least 100 years. I could build you a case it was 120 years to build this ark. But sentence had already been pronounced. The day that the Lord told Noah to build the ark, his mind was already, just like a judge, banged the gavel, boom, guilty. And the sentence, you know, the sentencing phase comes along, and I'm not a lawyer by any stretch of the imagination, but I've watched a little TV. I know y'all find that shocking, but I've watched a little TV. And my understanding is, from what I've watched on TV and the news and in law cop shows and such, is that sometimes when they, and I don't know what circumstances that allow this, but sometimes the sentence is carried out or levied, then there's a few days. And I'm just making an observation here, but it seems to me like the more wealth and notoriety you have, the longer the days are. But there's a certain number of days before you have to report to the penitentiary or whatever it is for your sentence. That's kind of what I believe is going on in Noah's day. God's pronounced sentence. You're all done for. But it's 100 or 120 years before it's actually carried out. And during that time, you've got this man named Noah and his three boys, and they're doing something that's never been seen before to save them from something that's never been seen before. It's not rain, see. They're building something the likes of which nobody's ever seen. The engineering, by the way, of that, which I am an engineer, the engineering of that, by the way, is spot on. But it's never been done to save them from a flood that nobody's ever seen. So during that time, don't you think that there was a lot of questions? What are you doing here? You know, why are you doing this? Oh, okay, so that's what's going to happen. Well, it's been 40 years, Noah. Nothing's happened. And it's been 60 years, Noah. Nothing's happened. It's been 120 years, 119 years. You know, nothing's happened. I expect it was clouding up by that point. But, you know, I can imagine that Noah ignoring all that and just going about his daily business, sawing, hammering, putting the pitch in, whatever he was doing. See, that's preaching. There's an old theologian. I think this is often attributed to Augustine. I'm not sure that it came from him. But he said, preach. He said to his students, preach the word. Or preach the gospel. If necessary, use words. Think about that for a minute. You preach every day. It might not always, for me, it's not always the gospel. I'm preaching something every day. And by his actions, the spirit that dwelt in him preached to all of those people that he was around. He preached to his family. And it was by the Spirit, the same Spirit that raised Jesus Christ from the dead, the same Spirit that allows Brother Chris and I and other ministers to get up and preach the glorious gospel, the same Spirit by which you believe on Jesus Christ. It's the same Spirit, see. He preached to them through Noah. It's always been a humbling thought to me that God, who does not need my help, allows me to preach his gospel from time to time. Could God pour the gospel directly into your heads? Absolutely. I wouldn't deny him any power. Wouldn't do me any good to. But he has allowed men the privilege of assisting him in that. And that's all. That's what I believe this is teaching. I know it's not teaching that Jesus went down and gave people in hell a second chance. I can prove that. Because at the end of the story, I think it's a parable and a true story. I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. But of the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man wants Abraham to go back and talk to his brothers. And he says it wouldn't do any good. Even if one rose from the dead, it wouldn't do any good. If they're in that place, they're in that place because they're not covered by the blood, see. So, he says, which sometime were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. You might say, well, they were saved by the ark. Yes, they were saved from the water by the ark. But that's not what this is talking about. This is talking about being saved by the water. From what did the water save these eight souls? You see, there was a wicked and evil generation. The Bible says that the thoughts of their imagination were only evil continually. Read the headlines lately? They were saved by water from that untoward generation. Then he says this, the like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us. Not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer for good conscience toward God. It's not the putting away of the filth of the flesh. In other words, some say, well, he's not taking a bath. Well, that's true. It's not designed to get your body clean. But I don't think that's what he's talking about here. What he's saying here is that it's not, water baptism is not what puts away your sins from an eternal perspective. But I'll tell you what it does do. It does answer the conscience. So that when you are concerned, when you get concerned, maybe you don't, but I sometimes am afflicted with that. When you get concerned, could God really love somebody like me? I can look back on my water baptism and the fact that that water baptism points to the baptism of Christ. You see, there are, I'm told, seven types of baptism in the Bible, and they all point, six of them all point to the one. That they all point to the baptism of Jesus Christ, which is his literal death, burial, and literal resurrection. He called it that himself. When James and John, the sons of thunder, and their mother, when they came to him and asked, "Can I sit on the right hand and the left?" He said, "That's not mine to give. So you don't know what you're asking." Then he said to them, "Are you able to be baptized with the baptism that I'll be baptized with?" Now, James and John, I'm not convinced that they really knew the gravity of their answer. But they said, "We be able." He said, "Oh, yeah, he said, you indeed will be baptized." But he said, "To give that's not mine to give, but yes, you will be baptized." What he meant by that was that, see, when Jesus Christ hung on the cross, he represented his entire family. When Jesus Christ cried out, "It is finished," he represented his entire family. When he went into the grave, you, as part of his family, went into that grave with him in representative fashion. And thanks be unto God, when he came out of that grave, you came out in representative fashion. And now we have water baptism. We've had a couple at Middleton Creek in the last few weeks, which is a little unusual for us to have two that close together. But we're thankful for them, of course. It just shows, you can preach the death of the old Baptist all you want to. The Lord's in the matter. They're going to keep growing. But baptism, water baptism, this is the way I look at it. It's almost like a wedding service where the bride in a wedding comes down and becomes publicly identified with her husband. You know, they may have been courting, which is the word I prefer. I got two daughters. We're going to call it courting. They may have been courting for some time. Not everybody may know that, but now it's come time they're going to make a public declaration of their love for one another and their desire to live together as a family from now until they die. That's the way I look at a baptism. You're making a public profession. You may have been sitting in the pew and thinking, you know what, like me, thinking, you know what, I can get all I need. I don't need to be baptized. I can get here. I can sit here. I can hear the gospel preached. They don't run me off. They let me stay. And you may think that the crumbs that you're getting are as good as it gets, but I promise you it's not. I promise you it's not. You will not enjoy the church as much. You may enjoy it. I did. I was stubborn. I'll just tell you, I was stubborn. And it finally, it just got to the point with me. I just didn't understand why I had to be what I thought was rebaptized. Finally, got to the point with me, and as I sat through a communion service in the back of the church house, I thought, I got to have that. I've got to have that fellowship. The way that they love one another and the way that they love the Lord, I got to be a part of that. And then it was, I understand why I got to be rebaptized, but just do it. I'm done. I'm ready. Let's just go. You know, here's water. Let's get it done. Because I desired that fellowship so much. Now, I understand now why my first baptism, if you can call it that, was not sufficient. But and if you got any questions about that, I'll be happy to try to talk to you after a while. But or I'm sure Brother Chris can explain it better than I can. But the bottom line was, there just came a time when I wanted to be publicly identified with Middleton Creek Church and with the Lord. He says, the like figure whereunto baptism doth also now save us. Now, I said earlier that water saved them from that untoward generation. The water is what's under consideration, not the ark. Now, the ark is a picture of Christ. Okay, the ark is a picture. We are safe in his hand. They were safe in that ark. That, by God's specifications, it was built. It was shut up. It had a window that could only let them look to him. They were completely safe in that ark from the water. But the water saved them from an untoward generation. I'm going to tell you, if you have not been baptized, if you have been dragging your feet on joining the church, but you are fed up with an untoward generation, there's no time like the present. Because you can experience the same salvation. It's not an eternal salvation. You're already eternally saved. You have a desire to, that's about the best news I can give you. If you have a desire a sincere, heartfelt desire to join the Lord's church, you're already saved. Eternally. But if you want to have a refuge, a place where you can come, where we don't blare Fox News or CNN on the TV all day, where you can forget maybe about the cares of the world, even if it's just for a little while. Oh, it shouldn't be, but even if it's just for a little while, I don't know what you're waiting for. Because there is a salvation that is available to you that you can only experience in water baptism and joining the church. And that's the two go hand in hand. You don't get water baptized and not join the church. And you don't join the church. At least you don't join Middleton Creek. I don't believe you do it at Little Union either without getting baptized. Because there's a salvation that awaits the child of God. You say, well, I've already been baptized. Well, you know, I've already been baptized and I want that kind of salvation. Well, you're here this morning, so I hope you experience some of that. But so one of the things that I try to reflect on is especially when we have baptisms like we've had, is my own. And I try to remember the feeling that I had on that first moment of coming up out of the water and thinking, I've got a home now. I belong with a people that love me and care for me. And I've done an act of obedience. I have been obedient under the command of the Lord. And that's a good feeling, brethren. I'm just going to tell you, it's a good feeling to feel as though I remember my parents when my dad would come home and he'd be pleased with what I've done. Now, that was seldom the case, but when it was, I enjoyed it. And I love it when from time to time the Lord looks down and says, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And there's no day like that, like the day you're baptized. If you can look back on that and see, there's a salvation in that. It's not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but it's the answer of a good conscience toward God. By the resurrection of Jesus Christ, he says, who has gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject unto him. I thank you very much for your very good attention this morning.